Thanks, Jeff, and good morning, everyone. So we'd like to take our thoughts for this morning's exhortation from our reading in Joshua, because as we've been following the children of Israel in our first portion readings, they've come now to the brink of the promised land, and in today's readings, they've finally entered in. They've entered into that rest, and it's certainly a beautiful picture, isn't it? They've suffered for 40 years in their wanderings through the wilderness. All those rebels from 20 years old and upward have been consumed. And the next generation is now ready to enter into the promised land. But before we consider this glorious time, and of course the lessons which we hope to gain from it, we're going to take a bit of time first and see what has brought us up to this point, what has brought the children of Israel through up until this point as they stand at the very borders of the land. And so that's the reason I've asked our brother Jeff to have 1 Corinthians chapter 10 read for us. Now what we get from 1 Corinthians chapter 10 is the type of the wilderness wandering, the type of the exodus from the land into our lives. And just as the children of Israel were baptized as they passed through the Red Sea as they left Egypt, so our death and resurrection through the waters of baptism marks our exodus from death in the land of Egypt, the corruption of this world, into newness of life, into the life of life in Christ. And this is reinforced for us in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 in verses 6 and verse 11. Verse 6, now these things were our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And in verse 11, now all these things happened unto them for ensamples, the AV margin says, for types. And they are written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the world are come. So all that we read then, all the story of the wandering of the children of Israel from their baptism in the Red Sea to the kingdom or the promised land is essentially a diary of our lives. So before we can rejoice with them in the kingdom, in the promised land that they are entering in our Joshua reading, we must first make sure that we understand the journey that they went through. Because, in fact, it is actually our journey. So, starting in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, then we'll read the first few verses. Moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And did all eat the same spiritual meat, and did all drink the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. And now as we read verses 5 to 7, we'll start to see some of the things that befell them in the wilderness. And what we want to really try and do is not to have them there as the children of Israel and their issues, but to really try and bring them home to us and see how these very same things, maybe not identical circumstances, because we're not in a wilderness with perhaps 2 million people camping, but they are definitely real lessons for us today. So verse 5, but with many of them, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now, as we read before, now these things were our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Neither be idolaters as some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. So this is as a reference back to Exodus chapter 32. And maybe just keep a finger or a marker here in 1 Corinthians 10, because we'll be going back and forth a fair bit. So Exodus chapter 32 is the account of where this passage Paul is quoting from or referencing here in 1 Corinthians. So Exodus chapter 32 and the first six verses When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said unto him, Up, make us gods which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what has become of him. And I think we're pretty familiar with the story. So Aaron breaks off their golden earrings and the gold that they had off their sons and daughters, and he puts it together into a golden calf or a molten calf in verse 4. And he says to them, These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And verse 5, he sees it and he builds an altar. This is Aaron. And he makes a proclamation. And this is interesting. In the face of this golden calf, Aaron says, Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord or to Yahweh, the true God, as he says, in front of this golden idol. So they rose up in verse 6. They offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. They sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. So what's happened is the people here have attributed the works of God, the incredible deliverance that God wrought through them, they have attributed this to someone else. They attributed this great deliverance to the calf. As Aaron says, these be thy gods which brought thee up. It wasn't the God Yahweh, it was these calves. And Aaron proclaims a feast to the Lord in the face of these calves, as we've talked about. So how do we do this? How is it possible for us to do this in our lives? And in this example, the issue really is trust. They have attributed the actions of God, the works of God, to something else. And they were turning to another source for guidance and direction. It's more here in this case than just a distraction by our possessions. Now, we can do the same thing and fail in this issue of trust by things like building up our retirement funds. Not in the spirit of stewardship, but like the man in Luke chapter 12, which we know, who had great possessions and he built up his storehouses and said, you know, take your ease, you've laid up for many years. And he trusted in himself and he trusted in his wealth to take care of him. But of course, we know how the story ends in Luke chapter 12. Now, we can also do this by turning to other books or other writings beside the Bible for our guidance. And unfortunately, many within the Brotherhood have and are doing this, especially in regards to the roles of men and women and to homosexuality. And there's other examples as well. But if we look, we can find support for whatever we want. We can find justification for whatever we want if we look in other places outside the Bible. We can get proof. We can get whatever we want, whatever resources we want. If we look outside the Bible, we can find to back up anything that we want to believe. We can do this by elevating certain brethren and sisters and following them. We must remember to always follow God's instruction and God's guidance, not to follow our heart, not to follow religious leaders, but only the words of Scripture. So that's an example of how, in the Exodus account, maybe the identical circumstances are not there, but certainly the principles are that we need to be able to be aware of and learn to be wary of in our lives today. So back in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, the next issue is found in verse 8. Neither let us commit fornication as some of them committed and fell in one day 23,000. So this is a reference back then to Numbers chapter 25. Numbers chapter 25 is the story of Baal Peor. So I think, again, we're relatively familiar with the story. The children of Israel took wives of the daughters of Moab, and we know, of course, that was not acceptable for them to do. So fornication, then, is infidelity, straying from your spouse, as we can look at it today. And we can do this by mixing other religions into the truth, false views of salvation, perhaps, which many other Christians hold to. Perhaps some New Age philosophies of you know, trusting in ourselves and following our hearts and our own intuitions. Now, these are the type of things which can constitute fornication or impurity or infidelity in the truth. And of course, I mean, there's the obvious and the literal fornication and adultery, which of course is against the commandments of God, and we must maintain pure relationships in the sight of God. So we'll be back here in Numbers, but our next issue in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 is in verse 9. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents. So this is a reference to Numbers chapter 21, just back a few pages from our story of Baal Peor. Numbers chapter 21 and verses 4 to 6. And they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Edom. And the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. And the people spake against God and against Moses, "Wherefore have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread, neither is there any water. And our soul loatheth," that's a hard one to say, "loatheth this light bread. And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much people of Israel died." So this manna, this provision of God, which he had given to them, the people despised it. And we know the parable. We know the type of Christ as this manna. And so when we read in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, when it says they tempted Christ, this is exactly what it's talking about. It's not that Jesus was there, literally, or he was in heaven with God in some sort of pre-existence. But they despised the manna, this light bread, as we read here in verse 21, in verse 5 in the AV, or vile bread, as it means. And as we see, this is a representation of Christ. So this is how they tempted Christ. And so how does this fit into our lives? How do we tempt Christ? How do we despise Christ in our lives? And perhaps we can do it by, as Peter did, as he denied his Lord three times. And it's easy to do, isn't it? Many of these things are very easy to do. They're easy to slip into. They're easy to not pay attention and to get caught up in. And it doesn't even need to necessarily be an open, flat denial or rejection of Christ, as Peter did. It's an example for us to use because it seems to be rather extreme. But even just perhaps a passive sidestepping of something that maybe we could say or should have said, or a stand that we should have taken with people that we work with, our colleagues or friends at school, or perhaps it's a witness that we should have made and didn't, as opposed to a blatant rejection and denial of Christ as Peter did. There's often much more subtle ways that we can do this, that we can despise Christ. And it's so easy for us, isn't it, to look at the faithlessness of the children of Israel in the wilderness. And we could say, you know, how could they do this? How could the people be so blind and so rebellious? They have all the signs. They have the tabernacle right in front of them in the middle of the camp as a witness. They had the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. They had the priests. They had the manna every single morning. The list goes on. But you see, when we break down the lessons into ways that we can take them into our lives that are relevant to us in this day, often, in fact, we're no different at all, are we? We have been baptized. We have been brought out of Egypt with a great deliverance. And we have all these scriptures to warn us. We have an assembly of believers here. We have a congregation to walk with. And yet still we fall into those same traps that they did. Really, we're no better. So as we continue here in Numbers chapter 21, we find the anti-venom for the sting of the flesh. Now, we have the same anti-venom as they did, and that is Christ on the cross. And they simply had to look in faith at that brazen serpent that was lifted up, and they were healed. And so it is with us. If in faith we look to Christ, we may have our sins forgiven and ultimately the curse of mortality lifted. So back in Corinthians, maybe keep a finger here in Numbers because we're going to be back again. Back in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, reading verse 10, "Neither murmur ye as some of them also murmured and were destroyed of the destroyer." And this is a reference then back, as I said, in Numbers, back a few more pages into Numbers chapter 14. Numbers chapter 14 and verses 1 to 5, "And all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron and the whole congregation and said to them, Would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would God that we had died in this wilderness. Now wherefore hath the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? Were it not better for us to return into Egypt? And they said one to another, Let us make a captain and let us return to Egypt. Then Moses and Aaron fell on their face before all the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel." So the people wanted to return to Egypt. They'd been brought out with this great deliverance. They'd been brought to the land, right to the borders of the land. And they'd been, unfortunately, because of a lack of faith, they'd been blind, they'd been awestruck by the giants in the land. And it seemed an insurmountable task that they were facing. So they wanted to go back into Egypt, and for some reason, again, some reason, we do the same thing, don't we? They thought that the life of slavery and death in Egypt was better than what God could offer them. So how is it that we have this attitude, or we do this in our lives? It's when we turn back to our old way of life, isn't it? Once we've been baptized, once we've decided to be baptized, and we've come out from our old way of thinking, our old way of life, we can never return there again. Yet sometimes we do, don't we? Have you ever thought or said or perhaps heard another brother or sister say something along the lines of, if I wasn't in the truth, I would whatever. You see, that's turning back. That's thinking back into the land of Egypt. And it's easy for us to think sometimes, you know, if only I didn't have to wake up on a Sunday morning so early. If only I didn't have to have this, you know, this morality, this code of conduct, which I'm, you know, trying to follow to be like Christ. I could cheat on my taxes a little bit. I could get a bigger return. I wouldn't have to claim this or that. I wouldn't have to work so hard for my boss. You know, I could just slack off when he wasn't looking. I could spend a lot more time doing those things that, you know, that I really want to do. It's the attitude of the older son in the parable of the prodigal son, isn't it? He murmured. Why can't I have a feast with my friends, is what he said, didn't he? It's easy for us to be spiteful and unappreciative of the great honor that we have and the privilege we have of this high calling. And so then, back in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, we'll read verses 11 and 12. "Now all these things happened unto them for ensamples or for types, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed, lest he fall." So all these things are recorded for us. They're for our admonition. And so we are warned to beware of our position before God. And we know the severity of the punishment that God meted out to the children of Israel in the wilderness. So we know what he thinks of these things. We know the severity of what we're dealing with. And although we are not struck by a bolt of lightning or bitten by a serpent or destroyed by a plague every time we sin, we can't lull ourselves into thinking that it doesn't matter. But the encouragement comes in verse 13. "There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that ye may be able to bear it." So God knows our frame. He has made us. He has created us. He knows the frailty of our mortal bodies. He knows the frailty of our wills to follow him, and he has provided a way for us if only we will follow. Now, we can't ignore the reality of the journey in this parable of the children of Israel. God does not bring them out of Egypt, and the next day they're in the promised land without a hiccup. He doesn't work that way, and neither do our lives. The journey of our lives now is what prepares us for the land. So we can't have our head in the clouds. We can't be salivating over the glories of the age to come. We can't be so far-sighted that we stub our toes on the obstacles right under our nose, or we walk off the edge of a cliff. Now, it has to be our vision, no doubt. But it is that vision which shows us how to order our steps today. It is the vision that illuminates our path as we walk each day. The two, our walk and our vision, must work together to ensure that, A, we know where we're going because of our vision, but we know how to get there with our walk. So these are all things that we experience and we struggle with daily. But as we continue in the parable into Joshua chapter 5, which we have as today's reading, chapter 5 and 6, we look at things that are now future to us. And we're going to try and look at some of them and hopefully create a little bit of a better picture of where we are going. The whole point of these trials and tribulations which we face each day. Now, I don't know what all of these things mean in exact detail here in Joshua chapters 5 and 6 or even in chapters 2 and 3 and on into chapters 10 and 11 and so on. I don't know exactly what, none of us do. We don't know exactly how the return of Christ will look precisely to the exact detail. But we do know that if the wilderness wanderings are a parable of our lives, according to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, then certainly according to Hebrews chapter 4, the conquest of the land and the entering into that rest is a prophecy of the establishment of the kingdom. So I want us to use our little imaginations, a little as we go forward in this next section. We've looked already at some things that pertain to our lives right now, today, tomorrow, the way we live each day, and hopefully now we can take a minute to look at some future things, some things that will come to pass with the return of Christ. So first, turn with me to Joshua chapter 3. I've just picked out a few little details here to look at, some of the ones that are probably pretty straightforward and pretty clear to point forward to future events. So Joshua chapter 3 and verses 14 to 17. And it came to pass when the people removed from their tents to pass over Jordan, and the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as they that bear the ark were come unto Jordan, and the feet of the priests that bear the ark were dipped in the brim of the water, for Jordan overfloweth all its banks at the time of harvest, that the waters which came down from above stood and rose up on a heap very far from the city Adam, that is beside Zaratan. And those that came down toward the sea of the plain, even the salt sea, failed and were cut off, and the people passed over right against Jericho. And the priests that bare the ark of the covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all the Israelites passed over on dry ground until all the people were passed clean over Jordan. So what does that mean? What's going on here? Well, essentially, the water from Adam that flowed down from the city of Adam was cut off, stopped. And all the water then drained completely down to the Dead Sea, and it was dry land. So what's a parable? What can we get out of this? Well, the flow of all life from Adam is to death, into the Dead Sea, where there is no escape. Everyone who has lived has made this journey, so to speak, down the Jordan into the Dead Sea and dies. And what's happened here is as the people passed over into the land, that law, essentially, that has happened for all of time has now been broken or has been interrupted. And that flow of mortality down into the Dead Sea has been stopped. And so those that passed over on the dry land, those that entered into the kingdom, were not under the curse of death and of mortality any longer. For they'd passed over and they'd passed through that. And so I think that's kind of an interesting point, something that we can look forward to, just in the little details here when we break it down. So we know then that those who enter into the land will be breaking through that barrier of mortality and death. Come over into Joshua chapter 5, which we read today. And one of the first things that they do once they enter into the land here in Joshua chapter 5 is in verses 2 to 7. And they recircumcise all those who had not been circumcised. And we know now that circumcision is the symbol of the covenant that is cutting off of the flesh. And we do that today, the foreskins of our hearts, as a term is called. And we cut off the flesh out of our lives. And so when they enter into this land, this covenant, this commitment is then renewed. And this is one of the first things that happen as they come into the land. Now, as a bit of an aside, it's interesting to note, I don't know if this is perhaps in line with this, the spiritual future lessons that we're talking about, but it's interesting to note that circumcision was not performed in the wilderness. The people had neglected to pass on that covenant to their children. Now, are we guilty of this as well? Are we neglecting to teach the truth? And this is not, I don't mean the Sunday school teacher's job, but are we guilty of neglecting to pass down this covenant to our children? Now, children are not dumb, so I've been told. I actually don't have any. But they will pick up from parents what is actually important in their parents' lives. Now, you can tell your kids or anyone, you can tell people all you want. But if they see that you don't care, or that the truth means very little in your actual life, in your daily life, in the decisions that you make, then it doesn't add up. And they'll pick that up right away. People will pick it up right away, that inconsistency. And so perhaps the children of Israel were telling the stories all along, but it really meant nothing in their actual lives. And so their children and the generations following didn't pick it up. And we'll just turn quickly into Judges chapter 2. Where evidence of this is strong. Judges chapter 2 and verses 6 down to 10. Now this is once they were in the land. And Joshua let the people go, verse 6. The children of Israel went every man unto his inheritance to possess the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord that he did for Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, served the servant of the Lord, died being 110 years old. And they buried him in the border of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres in the mountain of Ephraim on the north side of the hill Gaash. And also all that generation were gathered unto their fathers, and there arose another generation after them which knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. And we can think, how is that possible? They'd come out of the land of Egypt through a great deliverance. The army of Egypt had been completely destroyed. They'd been preserved miraculously for 40 years in a barren and a parched desert. Their shoes didn't wear out. They always had enough food, whether it was gourmet as they wanted or not. They survived. They were brought into the land. They'd just completed this great conquest. And their kids didn't even know. And it's humbling because, as we see, this is a parable. This is a parable for us. And it just emphasizes the need for us to pass on what may be such a great moment in our life, our baptism or our conversion. It's our duty to follow that on, to pass it on to future generations so that the truth is upheld. And that, as we read here in Judges, that We never get a generation that doesn't know the Lord. So, sorry for that little digression, but back in Joshua chapter 5, as they come into the land, now this is interesting from a very human point of view. This is an incredible tactical error on the part of the Israelites. You don't go into the land, into the territory of your enemies, and then incapacitate your whole entire army by circumcision. But that's exactly what they did. As they went in, and they just came just inside the border, they just crossed over the Jordan, and then, of course, they were all circumcised, which would render their army essentially useless. But, of course, we know that God was fighting for them, and terror was in the hearts of the inhabitants of the land, so they ended up being okay, of course. So the third point, then, I'd like to take is out of verses 10 and 11. Of here in Joshua chapter 5. And the children of Israel encamped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at even in the plains of Jericho. And they did eat of the old corn of the land on the morrow after the Passover, unleavened cakes and parched corn in the selfsame day. So they celebrated then this Passover. They celebrated their liberation from the bondage of Egypt. And we know that as we enter into the kingdom, we too will celebrate our liberation from the bondage of sin and death. And we'll join in that great feast, that marriage supper of the Lamb. Continuing in verse 12, the manna ceased on the morrow after they had eaten of the old corn of the land. Neither had the children of Israel manna any more, but they did eat of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. So, what do we know the manna to be? It's the bread from heaven, right? It represents Christ. Well, this daily provision of manna has now stopped. Well, they wouldn't need that daily provision anymore. We will not need that daily provision, the daily reading of the word, when Christ is with us, or we are with Christ. So I think that's another interesting point as well. And they ate the fruit of the land, which when we, by God's grace, are in the kingdom, we will eat of the fruit of the land and not be burdened with this mortality any longer. And of course, as we continue on then into chapter 6 and we have the story of Jericho, we know that the conquest of the land or the destruction of the nations as we get all the way through into chapter 10, talking of Armageddon and the military conquest of Christ to establish the kingdom in the land and to assert his authority over all those nations of the world which will seek to rise up against him. So hopefully then we've got some interesting thoughts for us to think about. And as we come now to the emblems before us, we see in them the life and the death of our Lord and our Master. We've considered the parable of the wilderness wanderings this morning and the rest that awaited them in the promised land. And we take it to us as we struggle through this wilderness of our lives. And we look to the coming of the Lord and the promise of his kingdom. And as Christ was with them daily in the manna, and as Christ was in the water from the rock once at the beginning and once at the end of their journey, so Christ must be daily in our lives. And he already is, as the manna already was. But if we take no notice, or if we murmur against him, then we are no better off than the rebels which died in the wilderness. And of course, brethren and sisters, we look to that day of his return, when he will lead us once more through the waters of baptism, this time to literally share in the newness of his life, in immortality as we work with him to establish that great and glorious kingdom on this earth. And we'll conclude with one final passage from Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews chapter 3 and verses 12 to 14. Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily, while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. For we are made partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast unto the end.